Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rutan.
And it's another one of those weeks, Ken, in which the worlds of sports and politics seem to be at one. This week, Lance Armstrong, new allegations of doping. And at the same time, Alex Rodriguez, one of your heroes, one of your New York Yankees, hit his 600th home run. But he, too, has been accused of using drugs to enhance his performance. Your thoughts, Ken?
Ron Elving, I have a question that a lot of Americans, well, one American, the listener, wants to know. How do we do the podcast week in and week out without steroids?
Easily answered, Ken, we don't.
Well, actually, no. I mean, a lot of people talk about doping. I think we should have some dopes doing the podcast. I think we have. I am a little bit dopey, but a little sneezy and bashful myself.
It's also a week in which the branches of the government have been in some degree of conflict. We have seen the judicial branch getting involved in the legislative branch, and we have also seen the voters brought in to express an opinion after a fashion with respect to the legislative branch. Cover that for us, would you?
Well, let's start with Prop 8 in California. That was tossed out by a federal judge this week. Only affects California, but it does change the political landscape in California, perhaps 2010 and maybe even 2012.
Oh, it has an enormous national impact because Proposition 8 had been seen as overturning the effects of earlier judicial rulings in California and wiping out what had been one of the most liberal attitudes in the country towards gay marriage, at least in the law. And when the voters came back and passed Proposition 8 and just essentially threw all of that out, that was then challenged in the courts. And now we have a federal judge who will soon have his ruling tested by a larger appeals court in San Francisco than the Ninth Circuit. That will almost certainly, whatever their decision, go up to the Supreme Court. Over the next couple of years, the United States Supreme Court is going to be asked to rule on whether or not, in essence, gay marriage is a constitutional right.
Yes, but whenever it gets down to the level of the voters always, I think every time, vote a certain way. There are many states where gay marriages have been tossed out by the voters, and federal courts have not ruled on that yet, but ultimately the Supreme Court will rule on it. But if this becomes one of the side issues of the fall campaign, very possible that the Republicans come out ahead, even though this 8 was thrown out.
That is certainly the view of people like Karl Rove, who was careful to make sure that there would be as many anti-gay rights initiatives on the ballot in certain states, in swing states, in 2004 to guarantee a big turnout among social conservatives,
You'd have a big turnout whether it was a pro-gay initiative or an anti-gay initiative.
Yeah, it brings people out. Right. But I think that But it is particularly effective if it can come from the anti-gay rights side, because there you can word it in such ways that it particularly appeals to people, such as the Ohio proposition in 2004.
And that's perhaps one of the reasons why George W. Bush was elected in 2004.
Well, I think there are a lot of people would tell you that's how Bush carried Ohio, that was very much the reason for putting that on the ballot that year. And there have been other states as well. But Ohio is critical because that was a swing state and decided by about 100,000 votes.
And that decided the election in 2004. And it could have very well decide again 2012. But even before we get that far, now we have something that's been decided in August. There'll be no language, no wording on the ballot in November.
It's probably going to be an issue that candidates bring up, even if it isn't on the ballot and even if it isn't a magnet the way it has been in some states like Ohio in 2004. It will still be in the political discussion. And you'll, I think, see a lot of anti-gay rights people saying, we challenge you, nominee for this office, that office. Tell us your position on Proposition 8. And they're going to have to at least take the sort of defensive posture of saying, well, it's in the courts. We'll have to see how that particular case works its way out. That doesn't really satisfy
anybody. No, but everybody plays that game. Speaking of which, this week, the Democratic National Committee is now instructing or advising their candidates to ask every Republican incumbent and challenger whether they support the Tea Party, the Michelle Bachmann Party. Alexei Giannoulias in Illinois, the Democratic candidate there.
For the Senate seat,
who President Obama is out campaigning for this week, has put out a challenge to Mark Kirk saying, where do you stand on it? This is a typical game. It's an old tactic to put the opponent on the defensive. White candidates used to do that to African Americans for years, saying, how do you feel on Louis Farrakhan or something like that?
Even Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson, too. But here's another initiative that's going to be coming to play in November, at least in Missouri, and that was Proposition C that passed this week on Tuesday's primary.
That's right, another case where you have the legislative product of Washington being questioned by opponents and being put on the ballot. So what they did in Missouri was they asked people, do you want to have a federal mandate telling you that you have to buy health insurance or else pay a fine to the federal government. And lo and behold, more than 70% of Missouri's voters said no. I'm surprised it wasn't 90%. I can't imagine why anyone would say, yes, I'd love to have a federal mandate forcing me to buy health insurance. When you word a question like that and when you ask people only, do you want the burdensome part of a law and not the helpful parts of the law, why in the world wouldn't they respond
but we
way?
See that in Congress all the time, too. We'll see the majority party, whatever party it is, will make sure to vote on an issue to embarrass the other side and put the other side in defense. Are you against raising the minimum wage? Are you against the Bill of Rights?
But nobody would then try to portray that vote in Congress as necessarily representative of how everybody in the country feels. Whereas the Missouri vote, which in my view is a completely stacked question, then in addition to that, was answered primarily by Republicans who cast about two-thirds of the votes that were cast in the primary on that Tuesday. Then this is portrayed as something other than a test of whether or not a stacked question does well among Republicans who oppose the health care bill. I mean, it is not in any sense a plebiscite and is not in any sense a public opinion poll of any kind of scientific validity at all.
Well, but because the reason more Republicans turned out in Missouri than Democrats perhaps is because more Republicans are engaged in the process or more excited about the elections than they are in Missouri.
Or because they had a more interesting contest at the statewide level.
Well, the only statewide race there was the race for the Senate. And both Roy Blunt on the Republican side and Robin Carnahan on the Democratic side were basically assured of nomination. So, I mean, to say...
I agree with you. People who vote have more say than people who don't vote. There's no question about that.
I mean, that's like saying the 2008 presidential race didn't matter because more Democrats showed up.
Well, that's not necessarily true because the race was decided by the disposition of the independent votes. But in this particular instance, what's being represented is not the result of an election. It's not we're electing one candidate or another candidate. It is people being asked a question, they respond to the question, and then the question is mischaracterized and the response of the people is mischaracterized as some kind of plebiscite on how Americans feel about the health care law.
But you know that already that Roy Blunt, the Republican who supports Proposition C, will run on that saying, I'm with 70% of the people of Missouri, and Robin Carnahan, the Democratic nominee who opposed Proposition C, he'll say, well, you know, she's part of that 30% minority who opposed the will of the Missouri people. It's a game both sides play, and I'll just see whether voters see through it in November.
There were a lot of other interesting primary results around the country this week, too, in terms of candidates, not just propositions. Probably the most interesting one was Rick Snyder in Michigan, the surprise winner.
You don't mean the one tough nerd.
His 10-point plan to reinvent Michigan is so detailed that, well, it's likely no politician could even understand it.
But it's the way to finally save our state.
Rick Snyder for Michigan. He's one tough nerd.
That's exactly who I mean, and I love that. I mean, has anyone ever campaigned for a statewide office in the United States of America before calling himself a nerd?
Well, I know there's a podcast in Washington with two tough nerds.
Yes, but Rick Snyder, Ken. Rick Snyder, the gateway computer entrepreneur who was the surprise winner of the Republican nomination for governor of Michigan. Now, there is a tough job, not one that everybody would want to tackle right now, but there were some other Republicans who wanted it, and Rick Snyder beat them out.
And Rick Snyder seemed to be the most moderate of all the candidates in the race. There was also Mike Cox, the attorney general who's backed by Right to Life groups, who is among the attorneys general who supported the challenge to the Obama health care law.
And Pete Hoekstra.
And Pete Hoekstra, the congressman who ran on national security credentials, who thought that, you know, as a member of Congress, he would do well, but he finished a pretty weak second, also very strongly pro-life. Rick Snyder seems to be the most moderate in the field, and he's running against a Democrat who a lot of Republicans feel is extremely vulnerable, and that's Virge Bonaro, who's the mayor of Lansing.
Yeah.
Backed by the unions, backed by the pro-choice groups.
And also has to represent the economy of Michigan the way it is, the way it's been, one of the worst in the country, double-digit unemployment for years. And Jennifer Granholm, while she was term limited, would have had a very tough time getting reelected, despite her political trajectory of a few years ago has really fallen on hard
times. A few years ago, we were talking about changing the Constitution, so Jennifer Granholm could run for president.
Ticket, you know, right, exactly.
She's born in Canada. Now right. They're running her out of town. Unemployment is way up. The economy is down. Manufacturing jobs have been – I mean, that's been a problem in Michigan for years. Probably for most of 8 years of Jennifer Granholm, but it's gotten much worse. And I think the Democrats are going to be hard-pressed to win that governorship, hold that governorship in November. And that's a big state, obviously, with redistricting coming up. That could be a big win for the Republicans and Rick Snyder. Another result that we have to talk about in Michigan before we go is in the 13th Congressional District. That's when Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick becomes the fourth member of the House to lose a primary for renomination this year.
Yes, interestingly, this is not a case of the sins of the father being visited on the son. This is a case of the sins of the son being visited on the mother.
Right, exactly.
The extraordinary turning against Kwame Kilpatrick,
former mayor of Detroit,
has now backwashed on his mother even 2 years ago in the primary. She had a tough primary, but this time she had a tougher opponent, and the opponent easily capitalized on the continuing problems of Kwame Kilpatrick. And even though she herself has not had ethical issues over the years she's been in Congress, she just couldn't escape the downward drag of her son's record against a very interesting new state senator who challenged her, Hanson Clark, who is Bangladeshi and African-American.
2 years ago, when Cheeks Kilpatrick was running for renomination, I think the only reason she won is that she had two very strong opponents who split the vote basically a third, a third, a third, and she barely eked out renomination. Clark was a much stronger one-on-one candidate. There were other candidates in the race. And interestingly, Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick herself came to Congress by beating an ethically challenged opponent, Barbara Rose Collins, years ago in the Democratic primary. And now I guess the same kind of thing came back to bite her. But as you say, Congresswoman Kilpatrick had none of the ethical problems, certainly, that Kwame Kilpatrick had, but she paid for it.
Let's go down to Kansas, where I think the most interesting race was the rather surprisingly close contest between Todd Tehart, the congressman from the Wichita area of Kansas, and Jerry Moran, who represents, the western two-thirds, three-fourths of the state. They both claimed the mantle of the conservative. They both brought in some stars of the conservative firmament from around the country, including at least an endorsement for Todd Tehart from Sarah Palin, which is the celebrity endorsement of the year.
From her Facebook page.
But he would take it, and he certainly played it up. And in this contest, Jerry Moran had the advantage throughout all the year, really, because he has such a large district and because he's seen as being closer to the heart of the Kansas Republican Party, a little bit more the, if you will, establishment candidate. But in the end, the activists, particularly the anti-abortion activists, seem to have turned out in great enough numbers to make it almost too close to call, but in the end, Moran did pull it out.
Right, it was like 49-45%.
49-45.
Which was absolutely right. And you mentioned Sarah Palin, but her running mate, what's it?
Yes, described in at least one account as Sarah Palin's running mate of 2008.
John McCain,
a senator from Arizona, endorsed Jerry Moran and was doubtless of some help to Moran in holding off the Tehart charge.
And the reason I think we're spending so much time on the Republican primary is that no Democrat has been elected to the Senate from Kansas.
1932.
And, matter of fact, Lisa Johnston, who's a Democratic nominee, probably the last time we'll mention her name on this podcast, Jerry Moran will be the next senator. Of course, the reason there's an opening is Senator Sam Brownback decided to run for governor.
And he's on his way.
Once upon a time, we kept talking about Kansas, how it's turning blue. We had Kathleen Sebelius winning two terms as governor.
They got a couple of seats. At one point, they had two seats in the House delegation.
Right. And now Dennis Moore is leaving as well. His wife, Stephanie, is running for that seat. But that once Democratic takeover of Kansas, which nobody ever bought, but it was at least a little storyline that looked kind of intriguing, is certainly not happening in 2010.
Kansas returning to form. You know, you talked a little bit about people who got into Congress running against the ethically challenged incumbent, and then some years later, they become the ethically challenged incumbent, fairly or unfairly, probably unfairly in Carolyn Kilpatrick's case. But we've got another case of that that's quite prominent right now in Washington, and that's Charlie Rank.
Right. Back in 1970, when the podcast was in its infancy and Ron was in his 40s, Adam Clayton Powell was the ethically challenged congressman from Harlem that Charlie Rangel, a young reformer, defeated in 1970. 40 years later.
40 years later.
Charlie Rangel is now fighting for his political life, not at the ballot box. He has a September 14th primary against, interestingly enough, Adam Clayton Powell IV, whom he once ran against and clobbered him in 1994. But anyway, he's probably still favorite, and yet...
Favorite in the primary, favorite in November.
Well, there's no Republican strength there at all.
But maybe not favored to get out of the woods on this prosecution, if you
will. Did you hear President Obama last week? It was very interesting.
Urged him to retire in almost so many words.
Yes,
he said, end your career with dignity.
Exactly. And that sounded like that was a signal saying, look, I'm sure there are a lot
get out before you're reprimanded. I mean, they're clearly going to have the votes for a reprimand after this hearing. spending.
Well, some Republicans will demand probably a censure. I mean, probably more.
They're not going to get it. Because the committee, which is equally divided between the parties, has already indicated that it's willing in some sense or another to accept or reprimand. That's probably going to be it. There will be many Republican voices raised saying he should be
expelled. That's what they did with Barney Frank. Remember Barney Frank?
Kick him out. Yes. Right, right. But in the end, he'll probably get that relative slap on the wrist. But there is a humiliation factor here. There's a lack of dignity factor. And that's what the president was referring to in urging him to end his career with dignity.
Well, Charlie Rangel would solve so many Democratic problems, I guess, if he just said, oh, you know what? I screwed up. I made these mistakes. Yes, I'm guilty in X, Y, and Z. There is, again, we keep talking about this sense of entitlement that somebody like Charlie Rangel, who never faces any kind of a political threat back home, that he just has nothing to worry about.
He's bulletproof.
He's bulletproof, and therefore I could have this villa in the Dominican Republic and not pay taxes. I can, you know, have these four rent-stabilized apartments for under market value and think I'm entitled to that.
And just say that I don't think that breaks any rules, and who knows, maybe he really thinks that it doesn't. One gets the feeling that Maxine Waters feels that what she did on behalf of a bank and a group of banks owned by minorities back in 2008 in the teeth of the financial crisis was no big deal and wasn't wrong, that she put together regulators who could actually make some money flow in the direction of these banks, including one where her husband had a substantial stake.
A former director and large stockholder.
Yes. That's right. And she had herself held stock previously in this bank. They got funds from the TARP program, and they got them after, not necessarily because, but they got them after they had had meetings with regulators that were set up largely by Maxine Waters, who is a subcommittee chair on the House Banking Committee.
Although the Treasury Department says that it was not because of Maxine Waters' influence.
Of course, and that is a point that she will make legitimately. But again, the appearance is that this was the improper use of influence, and being that her position is what it is, she should have stayed away from any kind of setting up of any kind of meetings that might be perceived as steering funds. She says, that's why I'm here, that's why I'm powerful, that's why I did it.
And like Charlie Rangel, she is defiantly refusing to accept any guilt or unethical behavior and is demanding a public trial. And again, with Charlie Rangel, with Maxine Waters, likely, unless they cop a plea, likely to have a public hearing, trial, whatever you want to call it, in September. That's the last thing the Democratic Party, the party that was going to drain the swamp of Washington when they came to power in 2006, that's the last thing the Democrats want. Charlie Rangel gave a lot of money to a lot of members of Congress who are quickly giving the money back, giving it to charity, but they're on the defensive. At the same time, you have the Congressional Black Caucus saying that you can't rush to judgment on Charlie Rangel and Maxine Waters.
And the House is trying to change the subject a little bit by coming back from their summer vacation. This is something you do not see very often or hardly at all. The House is actually interrupting their August recess to return next week and vote on $26 billion to go back to governments and schools and so forth to keep people on the payroll who otherwise would have to be laid off because of the low revenues in the state governments and in local governments. They're coming back to approve this money because, to their shock and surprise, the Senate actually approved it.
Because you had Snow and Collins, the two female senators from Maine, broke the Republican filibuster. Before we go ahead to next week, I know there's always risk talking about today, because today is being Thursday, but two events happening today that we should note. Elena Kagan, all but certain to be the next Associate Justice
of the Supreme
Court.
Apparently 63 votes. Five Republicans are on board and 58 Democrats and independents.
One Democrat voting no, Ben Nelson.
First Democrat to vote against the Democrats' nominee to the Supreme Court since the LBJ years.
Lyndon Johnson and Thurgood Marshall in 1967. No Democrat has done it since. Also today, the Tennessee primary in the 9th Congressional District, where Willie Herenton, the former mayor of Memphis, is running a race-based race against Steve Cohn, the white incumbent in an overwhelmingly African-American district. Herenton saying flat out, this is a black district, we should have a black congressman.
We need one black face in the Tennessee delegation. Right now we don't have one. That's his argument. But the president is backing Steve Cohen, the white candidate there.
Well, actually, he's backing every incumbent, so it just so happens that it's Steve Cohen.
And
too.
In this particular case, right, he includes Steve Cohen, and Steve Cohen is expected to win. Looking quickly ahead to next week's primaries, let's talk just a little bit about a big slew of results we're expecting from Colorado.
Well, it's Colorado, Connecticut, Minnesota, and the runoff in Georgia for Republican nomination for governor. governor, but the big story is Colorado. You have establishment versus the outsiders in both the Democratic primary for the Senate, Michael Bennett being challenged by Andrew Romanoff, and also on the Republican side, Jane Norton, the establishment choice, former lieutenant governor.
Being challenged by Ken Buck.
A Tea Party candidate who leads in most polls.
Yes, he does, and he appears to be the likelier nominee. Romanoff and Bennett is looking too close to call. Is Romanoff's really closed the gap?
Well, the last thing Barack Obama wants is one, an anointed candidate like Bennett, who was appointed to the Senate when Ken Salazar left, to lose. And he especially doesn't want the fact that he would lose to Romanoff, who was backed by Bill Clinton. I know the media got very excited about this. They made a big deal of it.
It's personal.
Yes, it is personal. A lot of people could say, well, look, Bill Clinton picked another winner and Barack Obama did not.
Well, except that Barack Obama didn't pick Michael Bennett. Ken Salazar left and he was chosen
by Governor Ritter,
who's now retiring, getting out of the picture. And by the way, the governor's race in Colorado is pretty interesting, too. John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver,
is the next governor.
Is probably the next governor because he's unopposed for the Democratic nomination. And the Republican side, well, the conservative side, is getting very complicated. They haven't a clear winner in their Republican field. And now they've got a third party in Tom Tancredo, the former Republican congressman, running as the candidate of the American Constitution Party.
The funny thing is Tom Tancredo says, you know, the Republican Party doesn't have a chance to win. Either Scott McGuinness or Dan Mays, the two Republicans running, don't have a chance of winning.
So if he's in the race.
So now he gets in the race and now they have absolutely no chance. Hickenlooper will be the next governor, the current mayor of Denver. Democrats keep that seat.
In Connecticut, their big question is whether or not Linda McMahon can hold off a late charge from former Congressman Rob Simmons, who's gotten back in the race and gotten serious about it and seems to actually be making a run at her, even as she's rising in the polls against the likely Democratic nominee.
It's one of those strange races where everybody has something wrong with them. Blumenthal with the problems about
the Democratic likely nominee.
Richard Blumenthal, the Democratic nominee, who with the problems with his Vietnam service, or McMahon, who with the steroids and the wrestling industry, and Simmons, who got out of the race and then decided to get back in. And it's hard to, you know, vote for somebody who has been kind of wishy-washy about whether he's staying in the race or not.
Are the Democrats going to take back the governorship in Connecticut that's been Republican for so long?
Yes, one of the candidates is Ned Lamont. There are several candidates running. This is the one that...
This is the Ned Lamont who knocked off Joe Lieberman as the Democratic nominee for the
2006
Senate,
right? And this is one that Governor Jody Rell is not running again. Also, another governor not running again is Tim Pawlenty in Minnesota. There's a three-way Democratic primary. There's a Republican primary, too. But among the Democrats running is Mark Dayton, the former senator, who says, if I'm elected, I'll raise taxes. What is it about Mondale, Minnesota Democrats who says, if you elect me, I'll raise taxes?
Or what is it about Mark Dayton? And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
The tax man's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon. And I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny